What do we have to talk about? Baseball, Neil. Bum ba da, bum ba bum ba ba, bum ba bum ba ba, bum ba ba ba. I think that was Star Wars there.
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, editor at 538. With me in the studio, Neil Payne. Hello, Neil.
Hey, Chad. What's up?
Neil, just the two of us today.
Just the two of us, but we can make it if we try.
Do you want Joe in the booth to cue up the...
Which
version
do.
Of the song? The Will Smith version?
The other version, sorry.
Is it possible you've already made this joke before on this podcast?
I think we have. This, we just episode. Keep I'm doing it. My life to you. Just the two of us. We can make it if we try. Just me and you. Just me and you. Just the two of us. Just the two of us.
Kate Fagan, it's out today, so it's just Neil and I, and me, rather. On today's show, the MRI results are in, and Stephen Curry is out. We'll discuss what Curry's injury means for the Warriors, the Spurs, and the rest of the league, as well as how the aftermath compares to Chris Paul's broken hand. And then the Chicago Cubs have scored 68 more runs than their opponents, nearly double the closest team's run differential. Is this the kind of hot start that we can believe in? Neil will give us his usual lecture about there is nothing that we can believe in.
Oh, come on,
baseball,
Chad.
I have a feeling. I'm just saying. You know,
Don't put words in my mouth.
I'm recalling the words that have come out of your mouth, Neil. Quite different. And is the Cubs' great start so different than, say, the Nationals' great start? And then we promised we deliver hockey. There's a very exciting game 7 between the Blackhawks and the Blues this week, and some very happy drunk Islanders fans just blocks from my apartment over the weekend. Neil Greenberg of the Washington Post Fancy Stats blog will join us to help us understand what's happened in the NHL playoffs so far. We will, of course, have significant digit. But first, Brady. Neil, where
As
were
always.
You when you heard that Tom Brady would indeed be suspended for 4 games? Thanks to a U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals.
I think I was sitting in an editor's meeting with you.
This is a landmark. My point is, it's a landmark event.
Oh, truly.
Neil. So we're not going to dwell on this too much, but we should just note, since this is Deflategate has essentially been happening for the entirety of this podcast's life.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
It never ends. That we've published some things on 538, published one piece by Benjamin Morris, our colleague, about what this might mean for the Patriots. The basic gist is that it could mean that they lose 4 more games than they would otherwise, or 0 more games than they would otherwise. But what he does look at is what an extra loss would have cost the Patriots over the last in Brady's span. And last year, for instance, it would have cost them the bye if they had just one more loss, and it would cost them the entire playoffs if they had 4 more losses. So you sort of have to bring in what you think about how valuable Brady is. Neil, based on your own handicapping, what would you say?
Well, you and I wrote a story last year where we used the Football Power Index, which is this ESPN sort of concoction that looks at a team's strength, but it also takes into account, I think they have like a special quarterback rating attached to it that modifies how well a team is supposed to play. And I think they said that losing Brady for 4 games would have cost the Patriots like a half a win or something like that, which sounds pretty low, I'm not going to lie. And I don't think we learned much about Jimmy Garoppolo's quality between now and then. But, you know, there's other estimates that would say that, you know, a starting quarterback, a really, really good quarterback like Brady is worth, you know, somewhere on the order of what, like 2 wins, 3 wins per 16 games. And that does kind of work out to being, you know, somewhere in the range of like, you know, half a win, 1 win, over like a 4 game stretch, not even 1 full win. So the Patriots are probably, you know, not going to, you know, if they get out to a cold start, I think we'll all, you know, we being the media, we'll all jump on this and
we
say,
will take those hot takes down.
Yeah, and then they'll provide us with a lot of hot takes
I'm so ready to be done with
Deflategate.
I mean, I said this a year ago, too. It is a perfect, I think, modern sports media story in that it features a major athlete who's both good at a sport and is an icon beyond the sport. It is an incremental news story that continues to churn slowly but surely and never quite dies, and so any iterative process is worth bringing down, discussing over and over again. And it breaks out and is actually about sort of governance within sports, which I feel like within the progressive sports corner of the internet is a very interesting topic and one that people like to obsess over. So in this instance, it's about Roger Goodell and the limits of commissioner power.
Yeah, and it's also about, you know, what kind of, in some sense, it's probabilistic, right? Like, you have to kind of take into account all of these different measures of evidence, and this is something that comes up not just in this really kind of weird, bizarre sports case, but in legal cases that really mean something. This kind of idea of Bayesian thinking of, you know, pulling together a bunch of different pieces of evidence and trying to figure out guilt or innocence probabilistically based on that. And just to do a plug, our colleague Brian Burke of ESPN Stats and Info, he actually built a little tool that has like little sliders that you can kind of move in certain directions based on, you know, how likely you think it would be that the ball boy would disappear into the bathroom for however long if the Pats were still innocent, you know, things like that. Ask those questions and then it'll give you the probability that based on your decisions that Deflategate was a case of cheating or not.
We'll put a link to that on our show page on 538. All right, so let's get to the thrust of the show here, to basketball. Where was Chris Jenkins mopping a floor when we needed him in the third quarter of Game 4 of the Warriors-Rockets series? Stephen Curry slipped on the floor, on a wet spot on the floor, and brought a little more sadness into the world, I think. No matter what your thoughts are, you know, even if you are a Rockets fan, I think you can appreciate the joy of watching the Warriors at full strength. And so when he slips and falls, people catch their breath. They hold their breath. Curry now has a sprained MCL and will be out at least 2 weeks. Charles Barkley thinks that this is apocalyptic.
This to me, listen, I disagree with Shaq. They got no chance of winning the championship without Steph Curry, in my opinion.
Winning the championship, yeah. I'd say continue to play well.
They're going to play well. They got a good, solid team, but I don't think it'd be the same way if LeBron was left, lost Cleveland. They wouldn't have a chance. If Kawhi Leonard, if he got hurt. But they got no chance of winning without Steph Curry.
Neil.
You know, Kawhi Leonard is pretty good.
Neil. Are the Warriors as cooked as Sir Charles thinks they are?
No. I mean, he said that there was a 0% chance. I don't think that's true. It hurts them greatly. There's no doubt about that. And we did a little study where we looked at the plus-minus metrics using ESPN's Real Plus-Minus, a metric of how good a player is and, you know, in terms of contributions to his team's success while he's on the floor. And, you know, do you take away Steph Curry from the Warriors and they go from being around 70 wins of true talent to being like 55-ish wins of true talent just on the basis of Curry alone?
So Curry's worth 15.
Curry
wins.
Himself is worth something in the order of 10 to 15
and does
wins.
And does that take into account what he means for the team dynamic or just his points, for example?
Well, no. I mean, it takes into account offense, defense, everything sort of, you know, implicit in his play also, you know, in terms of
it also takes into account what happens when he's not on the floor, for example.
Oh, yeah,
so that he's not running a pick and roll, that's baked in.
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, it can't take into account styles and fit and things like that. But in terms of just looking at, you know, knowing that he plays a certain role on the Warriors and that he is taken out of that role, you know, what we would predict the rest of the players to kind of do in his absence, that is kind of what we're asking of here. And if Curry is able to play, you know, the entirety of the rest of the playoffs at his usual rate, like he played last year, he didn't miss a single game in the playoffs, the Warriors would be, you know, a little bit better than 50% to win the championship. You've got Cleveland, you've got San Antonio.
And again, this is based on
the real plus minus ratings. Now, you take away Curry for 2 weeks, which is kind of the optimistic view of what the Warriors have kind of told the public, that he'll be reevaluated in 2 weeks. And we ran the scenario, and for those who are actually watching on the video, we have a chart showing it. If you take away 2 weeks of Curry, it drops the Warriors' championship odds by 14 percentage points, and it boosts the Spurs by 6 percentage points, and the Thunder by 4 percentage points.
And so, just so we're clear, 2 weeks of Curry gone is basically missing the next round of
the
playoffs,
next round,
but
the
coming back somewhere in the conference finals.
Right, coming back for the conference finals is what this would be.
So it goes down from 52% to 38%, a 14-point drop.
Right, exactly. So if Curry were to miss that next round, the kind of strange thing, and I can't remember a case of two players this good and who mean this much to their teams getting hurt in the span of 2 days or 3 days or whatever it was, but with Chris Paul injured and going to miss the entire rest of the playoffs, for him it's kind of unambiguous. You even heard Doc Rivers saying, like, he's done, he's cooked. That, you know, the Clippers would have been in such a position to capitalize on this.
Because they were likely to face the Warriors in the next round.
Right, they're up 2-1 on Portland. Not only did they lose in the game Monday night, but then they also lost Chris Paul, who is their best player. And so if that had not happened, their odds would have quadrupled in terms of winning the championship just by Curry not being there and standing in the way. And so now that CP3 is gone from the Clippers, it really honestly takes them completely out of the championship chase. Like, when we ran these numbers and we had to kind of rerun them overnight after the injury happened to Chris Paul, that they basically have a 0% chance, or near about a 0% chance of winning.
Because they'll still run into the Spurs in a reduced form, even if they were to beat the Warriors.
Right, and that actually helps the Warriors, you know, by the prospect of facing the weakened Clippers if they even win. Right now,
right,
they're tied at two.
Or the worst Blazers.
Or the Blazers, who are have a lower rating, although I think that Blazers actually might have a higher rating after you take Paul off of the Clippers. But anyway, so if all of that happened, you know, in reality, taking out Chris Paul, now you don't have as much of a roadblock in the way, and the Warriors can still go on, but then you have the Spurs waiting, and then you have the Cavs waiting.
So the Spurs, for example, if Curry misses 2 weeks, the Spurs, their chances of winning the championship goes up 6%. If he misses the entire playoffs,
it goes up a huge amount.
Right,
it goes up 23 percentage points. And that's all because we're assuming that the two-week scenario involves Curry coming back and playing like some version close to his usual self against the Spurs in the conference finals. But if you don't have that, then the Spurs are suddenly head and shoulders above everybody else in the West, and pretty much everybody else in the league, for that matter. And so also, if you take away Curry for the entire rest of the playoffs, the Warriors themselves, their championship probability dropped by 47 percentage points, from 52 to 5%. Now, you could argue 5%, to Charles's point, that 5% is not zero. In fact, the list of teams that have 5% chance of winning the championship right now is low, and the Warriors would actually be ahead of most of those teams.
Everyone but the Thunder, Cavs, and Spurs, essentially, depending on how things shake out in the West.
Exactly, yeah. And so on that side, it's actually the Warriors, not all is lost for the Warriors, even if Curry misses the whole rest of the playoffs, because, again, they won 73 games. Not all of those wins were generated by Curry. They still have unbelievable talent on that team, from Draymond Green and Klay Thompson and so on and so forth. But at the same time, the whole storyline of this season was the two dominant, historically dominant teams, both in the same conference, the Warriors and the Spurs. And now, if you take away one and make them less than historically dominant, then now it's suddenly all about, basically, we spent all season talking about the Warriors chase for 73, and now it's like, oh, by the way, this other historically dominant team now has kind of a clear path to the championship.
So Curry is supposed to be out for only 2 weeks, but that, I think these are the kinds of things that can often spin on. And,
well,
and
you know, 2 weeks
sure,
is the
sure.
bottom bound,
right? Exactly. And so, but either way, this has been a very exciting NBA season. It's been a historic NBA season. What we were hoping for was a culmination, as you said, between two great powers.
The collision course. And
it made me start to wonder whether or not these players are playing too many games. I mean, we've talked about this before, I think, on the podcast. NBA season's 82 games long. We have four, I believe, 7-game series for that team needs to win in order to win the championship. And then I was reading this column in the New York Times by Michael Powell about whether or not the NBA playoffs are too long just because they're too long. Like they take too long, let alone the injury. And Neil, I was wondering, I think you sat on a panel at Sloan about this. Like, is there an ideal playoff format for a sport like the NBA? We've talked on the podcast before about how NBA, the better NBA team usually wins in a best of seven mm-hmm. series because talent manifests over that seven game span. If you brought it down to five in the early rounds where there is more of a mismatch, would that have a drastic effect on the game? If you brought it down to three, would it have a drastic effect on the game?
Well, five, you know, for best of three out of five, we have decades almost of evidence,
right?
Because
this is a new change.
That.
Seven game series,
right? Yeah, the NBA had that up until I want to say the 2003 season, and you still, you know, the idea of an eight seed, I almost said 16 beating a one, an eight beating a one in the NBA was still incredibly rare. When the Denver Nuggets did that, and that iconic, you know, Dikembe Mutombo clutching the ball
on the floor over the Sonics.
Maybe
with Barkley way back when in the 90s that also did it. Am I making that up?
No, I mean, I think when Dikembe's Nuggets did that, it was the first time in the current format that it had been done. Maybe I'm wrong. But so, you know, even best three out of five tended to yield, you know, the quote-unquote right winner.
So what you often
team.
Hear from NBA watchers is that there's too much money in having all these playoff games, that every extra playoff game means extra revenue for a team that's hosting it. Though there is a certain disadvantage to a league to lose some of their stars to injury, right? I mean, like, it's not going to be in who shows up to the games, but it is going to be in television ratings. I mean, if I had the chance to see Stephen Curry for four games against the Spurs, seven games, then I'm going to watch much more. I'm going to be much more likely to watch than if I'm just watching a Curry-less Warriors team.
Oh, yeah, completely. And, you know, many people have tried to tie, you know, over the years, the 82-game pounding of just the regular season to, you know, the increased risk of injury and the fact that guys are having to play on back-to-backs and various other, you know, uncomfortable situations. They play worse. And, you know, I don't know that I've seen conclusive evidence that injuries are elevated because of that. It can't be good. And I think we've talked about this, especially with regard to schedule lengths and kind of the ideal format of a season, is that 82 games to kind of decide who the best teams are and who should make the playoffs for the regular season in the NBA is enormously too long. Right. Each individual basketball game is the equivalent of basically one NFL game mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, carrying evidence.
I still think, Neil, at 538, we should do something that we remake each league's schedule to make them perfectly balanced about how much information is being given to us.
Oh, yeah.
Baseline where maybe the NFL is the baseline, right? If you wanted to get an NFL season's worth of information, how many games would basketball, hockey, MLS, and then WSL, MLB need to play?
Oh, yeah, completely. And, you know, if you did that, you would find that the NBA's ideal schedule would almost be 16 games. Like, you know, the NFL has a 16-game season. That I think you would require, like, a 17 or 18-game NBA season in order to match the 16-game
NFL. And then you get to the
NFL.
Playoffs.
And then you get to the playoffs. Now, of course,
totally
ridiculous.
I love that.
And do we want to use the NFL as the model? Because, you know, as much as I've made the argument in the past that I think that the NFL strikes a really good balance between mm-hmm. competitive balance and also, you know, teams being able to kind of come out of nowhere and win. But at the same time, you know, I would be sad if I was deprived of basketball on weeknights, you know, like having to watch NBA games like once every Saturday or something like that. It just would be sad. So it's kind of a
we
tough,
say that, but are you sad? Are you super happy when you had Thursday night football? You know,
Thursday night football has bad games on it. But that's another story.
All right, let's leave it there and move on to baseball. The Chicago Cubs have won 14 games, 9 of which have been by more than 5 runs. Their run differential between themselves and their opponents is so nuts that the analytics suggest that they should be even better than they are now. That they should be indeed 16-2. That is essentially an .865 winning percentage, which, and I just want to pause for maximum effect here. If you were to extrapolate that out to a full season, if the current pace holds, Neil.
Which always happens.
Especially with the Cubs. The Chicago Cubs will finish the regular season at 140 wins and 22 losses.
Ooh, that's some Golden State Warriors-esque.
The next line of my script, Neil.
Oh.
Why aren't the Cubs the Warriors of Major League Baseball?
But you're just saying they are.
Tell me. You're supposed to tell me why not. You're saying they are?
Well, I mean, what do you mean by Warriors of, like, the best team in baseball? Yes, they are the best team in
historically
baseball.
Historically best. That's a pretty radical difference.
Well, are you talking 140 wins historically best?
No, better
or
than
2001
Mariners. Better than Mariners.
I don't think anyone would, at this point, even as well as the Cubs would say,
even
predict.
Even you? You're the one who's always telling me that early season baseball is not to be trusted. So now even you are telling me that there is no reason to so doubt what's happening that you would take historic wins off the table.
I mean, it's possible that the Cubs win 116 games. I wouldn't say it's especially likely at this point in the season, but we should check in later and find out. The thing is, to win 116 games, you have to be really good, and I think it's fair to say that the Cubs are really good. We thought before the season they're the best team in baseball. They've done almost nothing to disprove that in the first month or so of the season. Yet at the same time, you have to be really lucky. A team like the 98 Yankees, if you look at the performances of the players on that roster around in the surrounding seasons and extrapolate the total talent on the roster from that, you would think that they were probably about a 95 to 100 win team. And that's about as high as it gets. So you have to be like a 100 win talent team that also gets 16 games of luck in close games or by bunching, you know, runs together in innings or coming through in the clutch with runners in scoring position. Or that 2001 Mariners team actually had even less talent than that. They were like a mid-80s win true talent team that somehow exceeded their record.
The Royals of the early aughts.
Maybe. But the point is that the Cubs right now, we would not expect them to win at the clip that the Golden State Warriors won their NBA games at to get to 73 wins. But the Cubs are really good, like really good. We could be witnessing one of those teams that is in that discussion, you know, to win 100 games and join kind of
and actually deserve
that's a pretty
100
rare
games have
right.
That 100 win talent.
Exactly, that's a pretty rare group to be in.
So 538 this week unveiled after several months of work Major League Baseball predictions, the same as we do for the NBA and the NFL. These are this is an ELO power rating model that looks at which teams are the best teams in the league and does per game predictions that takes into account which starting pitcher is on the mound, since that has such an effect on which team is likely to win. The Cubs, the number one pitcher in the majors is Jake Arrieta, we should note. And moreover, the Cubs, according to this ELO model, are forecasted to win 101 games. So that suggests that they are a 100-win talent team. I guess some of the early wins are baked in.
Yeah, the early wins. But I mean, they're near about a 100 win true talent team according to this, and that is really, really good. But that's what we expected of them going right into the season.
So Neil, in the past, you've written about early baseball that sort of you have to expect teams to regress to the mean. And so I'm just trying to understand sort of whether that still applies to a team that was supposed to be good like the Cubs and actually is, as you've said a couple times, because a few years ago, you know, you wrote that we need to add 67 games of 500 baseball to a team's record based on seasonal data since the majors expanded. So how does that work? Are we just not going to add that regression into the Cubs' life?
Well, so that 67 game mark just represents when sort of what the record that they have is kind of once they get to 67 games, it's kind of like half of what you see is, you know, should half of the weight should be given to what you've actually seen so far, and half of the weight should be given to the preseason. And I think in the absence of, you know, information, or if you're just trying to do like a quick and dirty regression to try to figure out what pace a team is on, it's pretty safe, especially in Major League Baseball, where teams are just naturally bunched together, to consider that kind of prior winning percentage to be 0.5, you know, 50%, 500 record. And that was kind of why that regression happened. But I think it's still holds and is still as valid that once you get to that 67 game mark, you could take half of a team's record that you've observed and combine it with half of the preseason prediction of the Cubs winning 97 games or whatever Fangraphs had them at, and then you would bake those together and you would end up with a probably much more accurate, or, you know, marginally more accurate at least, estimation. Now at this point in the season, of course, they've only played, you know, what, like 17 games or something like that, 15 to 20?
19.
Yeah, 19. So you know, that means that the weight given to that preseason expectation is going to be very high compared to the weight given to that blazing Warriors-esque winning percentage. And so even in baseball, being the best team in baseball and being predicted to win 97 games, it implies a lower rest of season winning percentage than if you were the Golden State Warriors. So everybody's going to get dragged down and eventually kind of regress to the mean. Now, each team's individual mean is probably separate. You would not assign the Atlanta Braves the same prior winning percentage as the Chicago Cubs. But at the same time, you know, they're all going to be dragged down, and the Cubs will not win 140 games, but they'll, you know, be in the conversation for 100 before it's all said and done, if not more.
That's just what I do with my friends. We just converse about 100 win teams.
Oh, yeah, of course.
That's the only conversations we have. So just one last thing, Neil, on early season records. So the Nationals technically have
a slightly better record,
14-4 for the Nationals versus 14-5 for the Cubs. But their run differential is basically half that of the Cubs. And so I'm just trying to understand what that means for other good starts around the league. The White Sox have gotten off to a good start. The Dodgers a bit less so, but still quite good. And so like for a team like the White Sox or the Nationals, do you expect more regression in that scenario because you didn't come in with those kind of expectations into the season?
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So it really is. We have to wait until that third of the season goes by, and then we can start to maybe adjust our preseason expectations to meet with reality.
Right. I mean, I you don't have to wait until that point. I mean, you could start now. Yeah, that's right. You could start now, but the point is that the wait to the preseason is going to kind of overwhelm, even now at this point, like almost a month in, what has actually transpired. And so in the case of a team like the Cubs, who was expected to be good and they've been really good, then you don't really have to revise that much. You're kind of, it's confirmed what you thought. The Nationals were supposed to be pretty good, you know, mid-80s win team, and they've come out and played better than that, so you would kind of adjust them upward, but still kind of tentatively do it.
And the 538 model suggests they're now a 95 win team.
And
partly that's not entirely because of how good they've been, but it's because they've gotten a few more wins than they were expected to early in the season.
Yeah, and again, some of that is just, you know, the cost of or the value of banking these wins early in the season. I think as fans, we tend to have a thought that, you know, the early season baseball, the April baseball doesn't really matter that much, or we're kind of still feeling, you know, each team out and kind of, you know, we have to pace ourselves. It really is a marathon, not a sprint, as the cliche goes. But at the same time, these wins in April count every bit as much as
another
the
cliche.
Wins in, but they do. I mean, that's the point is that we don't give enough credence to that idea. But if you come out to a really blazing start, even if you're not actually that good, or if you're playing a little bit above your head, and I think the White Sox, according to the preseason expectations, you know, 14-6.
Right, the White
Sox
are forecasted to finish 88-74, despite a very similar record to Nationals.
Right, because the Nationals were supposed to be better than them before the season, and so it's kind of, you know, about extraordinary claims, to use yet another cliche, require extraordinary evidence, and so really a month of baseball is not enough evidence to completely overturn the, you know, season-long or multi-season projection that went into the.
You know, I've been waiting over a year to present you this plaque that is the hat trick of cliches.
In
you
one
really,
segment,
the triple crown, the hat trick of cliches. I mean, you
the
you
golden
really,
sombrero.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's still time for you to hit.
Was that a cliche?
The golden sombrero.
I mean, I think we kind of have brought in cliches even just into this.
That's just a saying.
It's cliche free living is impossible,
ooh,
folks.
Ooh, that makes an editor's heart ache. All right, listeners. I know you've all been waiting to hear us talk about the Mets and these MLB ELO ratings. Through that, you'll have to listen to Neil and my spinoff podcast, Panic City.
Oh, we're not going to do a condensed Mets chatter right now.
Send them to the real, authentic article. You know,
okay.
And by article here, I mean podcast. All right, let's leave it there on baseball, listeners. We'll talk to you about the Mets over at Panic City. We promised we'd actually pay attention to the NHL playoffs this year, and damn it, we plan to honor that promise. The Blackhawks are out, the Islanders are jubilant, and there's still one more first-round game 7 to go. To help us make sense and understand of everything that's happened so far, Neil Greenberg of the Washington Post's Fancy Stats blog has joined us. Neil, hello.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
All right, this is the first time we've ever had a double Neil situation.
It's
going to
be highly
down.
Confusing. But when we get Neil Walker on,
hey, yeah, do you want code names?
You can call me Greenberg if that's easier. So this Neil's show.
I think we need something more hockey. Is there a great Neil in NHL history? Or is the
I don't
NHL
think there's too many
Neil Broughton,
like Neil
right?
Walker may be like the best athlete ever. I mean,
the best Neil ever.
I think this is wrong.
We got to think more.
There really is a Neil.
There's
got to
be a cricket. There's got to be a cricket Neil somewhere out there.
Yeah.
All right. So let's get into hockey. The Blackhawks lost Game 7 to the Blues. I suppose I could say the Blues won Game 7 against the Blackhawks. But let's start with the Blackhawks. Neil Broughton, what happened?
You know, it was a situation where the Blackhawks just dug too big of a hole for themselves, and it wasn't we saw how good they were to be able to even make it into a seven-game series. But when you have a team like the Blackhawks, who were arguably one of the best puck possession teams in the league, especially after you adjust for score effects.
What do you mean by score
effects? So when you're in a hockey game, the team that's leading tends to go into a defensive shell and doesn't put as many pucks on net as the trailing team. Usually the trailing team will just start firing pucks at net, hoping for a goal or a rebound or something along those lines.
So it's the hockey equivalent of parking the bus almost in soccer, but a bit inverse.
Exactly. So what you need to do is, a lot of times you'll see, well, that we had more shots and we still lost. But when you adjust it for score effects, you'll be able to see more clearly which is the true better puck possession team. And you know, Chicago and the Los Angeles Kings, who also lost their series, were two of the best. But I just think that the net minding of St. Louis, they have a really strong presence in net. And with Brian Elliott, and he's a guy that is really able to get hot. And I know you guys know about small samples and all that. And when you have a goaltender like Elliott who is able to save most of the shots that he sees and get that type of lead in the series, it really does put the edge in their favor, even though you can argue that the Blackhawks were the better puck possession team. They were probably the more talented team coming in. They certainly had the best player in Patrick Kane, who by all accounts will be the most valuable player at the end of the year. But it just goes to show you, in hockey, it's really a game of mistakes, and the Blackhawks just made slightly more than the Blues and ended up going home.
Now, Neil, we had talked in one of our shows leading up to the playoffs about how this year's regular season was almost weird, like Corsi, you know, puck possession metrics like that didn't do a great job of predicting how well teams would play in the standings. And do you think that kind of held up in the first round? Like you mentioned, the Kings lost, a team, you know, like Chicago lost. These teams that traditionally have been really good at puck possession seem like they didn't make it out of the first round necessarily. But is that kind of just, you know, selective viewing on my part, or what do you make of that?
It is a little bit strange. Historically speaking, the team that is in the top three for adjusted puck possession tends to win the Stanley Cup. I want to say like 7 of the last 10 winners were in the top three. One of the outliers being the Pittsburgh Penguins, who were actually a very good puck possession team once they switched coaches. So, yeah, it's a little bit surprising that two of the top three teams are already out, and the third, Anaheim, has yet to close out their series. So, yeah, it's a little bit strange. I think it's for a number of reasons. One, the league has kind of picked up on the puck possession. Not to say that this is something totally new to them, but with regards to bringing the puck over into the offensive zone, carrying the puck as opposed to dumping it in, and just focusing more on players that can play instead of these thugs that are typically there just to fight. So we started to see more better players on the ice. So I think that mitigates it a little bit. And, you know, it's fluky, like you said. Sometimes it is just a matter of small samples. I know if we were to play that Chicago series 1,000 times, chances are you'd see the Blackhawks win more often than not. But they maybe win 55% of the time as opposed to 45%. So even the edge that they would have is pretty slight.
Now, to talk about the Blackhawks for a second and kind of do the postmortem on their season, this was the first time they had lost in the first round, I want to say, since before they started this kind of epic spate of success in the postseason. And, of course, they've won three cups. They've gone to numerous conference finals. I have to ask the question, is this kind of the end of a dynasty that we're seeing now? Or, you know, do you expect them to come back? And, you know, they've taken years off in terms of not winning the cup and then just been right back there. Or is this something that kind of spells the end of this Blackhawks era that we've seen the past, like, seven seasons or eight seasons?
Well, as long as they have Duncan Keith, Patrick Kane, Jonathan Toews, and Corey Crawford in net, they're going to be a solid contender. Now, will they extend their dynasty that we've seen in the salary cap era?
And you would call it a dynasty, right? Just to be fair, and kind of ask your opinion on that.
I would call it a modern dynasty, in that they don't have the five or six cups that we saw from the Edmonton Oilers or the three or four in a row that we've seen for some other teams. But, you know, them and the Kings have alternated over the past couple of years. Chicago does have three Stanley Cups in what we call the salary cap era ever since the 2005-2006 season. So it's certainly a modern dynasty, and it probably looks even better when you see how much they blew up the 2010 team after they won and were still able to win it again just 3 years later. So, yeah, I mean, I would say that they're a modern dynasty. I don't think they're a traditional dynasty, but it's hard to argue with their success. So as long as they have, you know, those key components, then it's certainly they're certainly going to still be competitive. I don't think we've seen the end of them by any means.
All right, so let's move on to the Islanders. Before the playoffs began, Neil, you wrote that none of the previous nine Cup champions had allowed more than 42 high danger scoring chances than they produced. So essentially, that the Islanders were bad on defense compared to their offense is what you're saying. And the Islanders ended the season at minus 53, and yet the first wild card team has beaten the first seeded Panthers in their side of the bracket. Did you see anything special in that series? My borough of Brooklyn catches a little Islander fever, or are we totally doomed against the Lightning?
No, I don't think that they're doomed against the Lightning, and I think the Florida Panthers were probably. They probably looked better during the regular season than they actually were, especially matching up against a team like the Islanders, who tends to have a lot of speed. And like in most sports, that gives you a slight edge. I don't know if it's enough.
Does it introduce more randomness when you have speed in hockey, where if you're a speed team that you can maybe upset more easily than you could otherwise?
Anecdotally, it does seem that way. There's no data to back that up yet. The hockey will start to have player tracking beginning next year, so we may be able to answer that question. But I think the key factor was certainly John Tavares. I mean, he's one of the best he's one of the best players in the league. He's only 25 years old, and you know, he had an okay season. He wasn't great during the regular season, but ended up having 9 points in the playoffs, 5 goals, 4 assists, and put 30 shots on net. And, you know, him along with the speed of the team, and then they got pretty good goaltending from Thomas Greece, is a recipe of success. And you talk about randomness. The goaltending, I think, is the biggest factor in terms of randomness, because goaltending is so difficult to figure out, not only from game to game, but even from season to season. And you hear the term hot goalie. If you have a goaltender that's seeing the puck well and is able to make a lion's share of the stops, that's certainly enough to get the upset going. And it's something that we'll probably see more as we go deeper into the playoffs.
All right, Neil, real quick, we have to run in a second, but did you see anything in the first round of the playoffs that shapes your assessment of what's to come, or do you still think it's a pretty parity-soaked bracket this year?
I think the West has a lot of parity. I'm not sure that the East does. We'll certainly get a better view once the Capitals and Penguins series gets done. A lot of a lot of people are expecting the winner of that to represent the East in the Stanley Cup Finals. But I do think the Capitals played really well. I know some were disappointed that there wasn't a sweep after taking a 3-0 series lead. But, you know, we talked about the randomness. I mean, they certainly had great goaltending. Their power play was on fire, and the penalty kill was really strong. If they can get anything close to that going forward, they're certainly going to be formidable. But the West, you know, with the Sharks and the Blues and the Stars and the Ducks, if they should happen to make it, or the Predators for that matter, that the West is way more wide open. I do think the Islanders, with their speed, have the best chance moving forward. Tampa Bay won't have Steven Stamkos, it looks like. So I would say look at the winner of the Capitals Penguins for the East, but the West, I agree with you, is probably wide open.
All right, very good. Neil Greenberg. It's been, you know, Neil Payne's so great. It's not surprising having two Neils around is actually quite handy.
Well, you've never seen us in the same place.
Oh, so interesting. You know, I have seen Neil's ventriloquist act and Neil Payne's ventriloquist act, and it's improving rapidly. So
you're giving away our secrets.
All right. Neil Greenberg
Neil
of the
Club.
Yeah. Neil Greenberg of the Fancy Stats blog at the Washington Post. Thanks, Neil.
Thanks a lot for having me.
And now, as always, time for our significant digit when a telling number from the world of sports is brought to us on a silver platter. There's the fourth cliche, Neil, that we were looking for. Boy. Brought to us on a silver platter from Joe Sykes, our producer, British Joe. I didn't mean to distill you down just in your nationality, Joe. That was rude.
Erstwhile producer. No, not. Sorry.
Ouch. You know that I have trouble with that word, Joe.
It's okay, Joe.
Joe, what is going on in sports these days?
Well, as you probably listeners probably know, I am a huge soccer fan. That is my raison d'être.
How would they know that? Just because we've covered soccer more since you've become
every
our producer?
Every time we've talked about
that's
soccer,
one of the reasons,
you've come in
and every
talked.
Time I come in, I talk about soccer.
Okay, go on. So you're going to talk to us about cricket.
Chad, very good, very good. It's got to be Leicester City. It's got to be Leicester City. The most extraordinary sports story of the year. Nothing can top this. So the Sig Dig this week is 5,000-1, which were the odds amongst all bookmakers in England of Leicester winning the English Premier League at the beginning of the season. They are now one win away.
They're on the cusp.
If they win on Sunday at Manchester United, they will win the league.
How many chances do they have to win?
I think they have four more games.
Okay. So it's very likely.
They're one win away. It's almost,
and others can lose and draw and whatever else.
Exactly. But to win it at Old Trafford would be, which is the Manchester United ground, would just be phenomenal. I mean, this is the home of, you know, Premier League champions over and over again, the most imposing venue in English football. And if they won it there, I mean, it would be an extraordinary achievement. I mean, it's an extraordinary achievement.
So 5,000-1, can we put that within American long shot odds?
Yeah, so just looking at a team like the, you know, Philadelphia 76ers before this season, they would have been something like 500-1 to win the NBA championship if you look at it. So, you know, that Sixers team, not good by any stretch of the imagination, and so them winning the championship would be a huge story. And yet you're telling me that this Leicester City story is so much more, it's orders of magnitude less likely,
because it's just so hard to maintain form for 38 games in the Premier League, especially when you have a team who cost overall £24 million, which is nothing. I mean, the Manchester City team comparatively cost around $310 million, and you know that's what's expected about how much you have to spend to win the Premier League. You know, $24 million, it's ridiculous, it's outrageous, it's not, I don't know how to express how
we can hear it
absurd
your incredulity.
This is you know, I'm an Arsenal fan, and we've spent 10 years in the wilderness because we weren't spending $310 million, we were spending, you know, maybe $40 million. But Leicester have just come along and blown all those sort of paradigms out the water. Give you another cliche, Chad. It's a paradigm shift.
So Joe, game change
in the world of English soccer.
So Joe, does this, if this truly is a paradigm shift or a game change, does that mean that other teams in the same kind of bracket as Leicester now have the hope that they could potentially turn things around? Or is it just such a 1 year kind of, I hesitate to say fluke, but like just such an outrageous accomplishment that it can't be replicated?
I mean, maybe. It's so out of the ordinary.
It's never happened before.
Blackburn Rovers won, I think, in 1996, and they were pretty unexpected. But they had some good players. I mean, they, you know, had.
But are they good in retrospect, or only, or at the time we thought they were good?
Not nearly as much of a shock, basically. But I can't see it happening again. But maybe there's going to be a change now, and every team in the league will think they can win it, which will be make the Premier League even more exciting.
Yeah, it's interesting. Some of the people that here at 538, when we were kind of talking about it, likened it to, at least in retrospect, the 1999 St. Louis Rams football team, who sort of were a downtrodden franchise for a number of years, but then Kurt Warner, the great grocery bagger turned quarterback, and Marshall Faulk and people like that. In retrospect, highly talented team. No one saw them coming, but they went on to win the Super Bowl.
But there's in the Premier League, it's so much more about spending power that there's no other way to do it apart from having a lot of money. This is
except what
Leicester did. So listen, watch it this Sunday. History in the making.
As has been well established, Jamie Vardy is just as holy as Kurt Warner. All right, that'll do it for this week's show. Thanks to Neil Payne. Thanks, Neil.
Thanks, Chad.
Joe Sykes, you stuck around for this part.
Thanks, Chad. That was fun.
Our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Thanks, Joe.
He's not erstwhile.
I am
either.
Indeed.
Our podcast top cat is Jody Avergan. We get production assistance from Tony Chow and Jonathan Yales and Ryan Nantel. It was a triple effort in the booth this week. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. You can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. We're also on iTunes. Subscribe to itunes.com/538. While you're there, review. Rate the program. Go see our other programs at 538. We've got the elections podcast. We've got What's the Point? Neil and I have our side venture, Panic City. Come listen to all of them. That's a lot of podcast listening that we have available to you. Hours every week. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.